Previously on Willing to Adapt.
We're talking about the Nutcracker Ballet, and then we're going to talk about the book The Nutcracker and the Mouse King, which is written by E.J. Hoffman.
It blurred the lines of what was real and what was not in a way that we only see today, maybe in something that's a little more avant-garde.
Hoffman, they talk about, he was a champion of the imagination run wild. That Hoffman was rebelling against the dominant movement of the time, the Enlightenment period, and its emphasis on rational philosophy. He believed strongly, as most of the German romantics at that time, that the imagination was being attacked by the rise of rationalism throughout Europe. Only way that an artist could survive would be to totally become dedicated to another way of looking at the world, to reclaiming nature, reclaiming innocence, reclaiming an authentic way of living.
Eric von Crumley.
And I'm Romy Reyes.
Have you ever wondered how a book becomes a movie?
Or how a movie becomes a musical?
Or how anything is adapted at all?
Join us as we talk about your favorite stories and all the changes that were made along the way.
But more importantly, why? This is Willing to Adapt.
So the production that we watched, again, was the Royal Opera Company's ballet version. Which we watched them when we watched Sleeping Beauty, and I discussed in that episode how I was exposed to them through my brother, of course, and it's our favorite company. One, because they put on great productions, and the sets and costumes are gorgeous, but mainly because of their acting, if you remember.
Yeah.
Their acting and expressions are just phenomenal. There are other productions where it's just purely technical and focused only on the dancing, but the Royal Opera Company does a great job of really like showcasing the acting ability of these people, these dancers and stuff. And I love that.
Yeah. No, I enjoyed it too.
Yeah. What I like a lot about their production is they add a prologue in the beginning. Remember? In the overture?
I don't remember.
So halfway through the overture, it shows Drosselmeyer in his workshop.
And oh, yes.
He has an assistant, and he sends assistant off masked to go deliver stuff early to the stall bombs. And then he goes to the Nutcracker, and in the back there is a painting of his nephew.
Yes.
And it hints that it's the same because the costume is the same. And he's kind of like pining over the Nutcracker. He's kind of sad. And then the painting of the Nutcracker changes. The lighting changes, and you see
his nephew.
Do you see his actual nephew as the Nutcracker behind the painting, like weeping and sad? And then it goes back to normal.
So that was something they added.
That is something they specifically added. That's not in
production. Yeah, I figured production, really. Most don't, because my wife mentioned at that point, I don't remember that. It's like, I don't know.
I like that because it gets you intrigued and it introduces a little bit of the backstory early. And I also really like their version because their version is one of the few versions that ends with her coming across him as in his human form in the end. Most versions just end with her waking up.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes. Almost every version ends with her just waking up and holding the Nutcracker.
Oh, okay.
And it's like, oh, it was a dream. It was so magical. But the Royal Opera Ballet Company, their version ends with her going out into the street all cold. And then the nephew walks by as a human, and he gives her his little capelet because she's cold. And then there's a moment where they both kind of recognize each other, and then they're happy, but then they go off. And then it finally ends with the Nutcracker being reunited with his uncle, Drosselmeyer.
Do you know if any of that was done in some of the original?
No. No, the original ballet just ended with just her waking up.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, and that was one of the criticisms, of course. One of the many criticisms. And even the George Balanchine version just kind of ends with her waking up.
Yeah, I think most of the ones
almost
I've read
every
about
version
ends with her waking up.
Yeah, but that's why I wanted to show you that version, because it's really fun how they do it, and it stays a little more faithful to the original Hoffman
story. It
does. Story.
Yeah,
and then you can tell it's supposed to be set in Germany, based off of some of the costumes, like the servants' costumes, especially are more cultural represented, and then like the buildings on the backdrop and stuff like that. You can tell.
Oh, yeah. No, I picked up on that, because at first I was like,
very Germanic,
because I know sometimes they tend to make things ambiguous. And this one, I was like, no, I'm pretty sure they're back in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I have a little bit of backstory information if you are intrigued, or if you have, do you have something you want to say first?
Nope. Go for it.
All right. So I came across this video on YouTube maybe a year or so ago, and I watched it, saved it for this episode, this podcast episode, because it was very interesting. Every once in a while, I come across something and I think, were you looking a little too much into this? But this one seemed like he had done his research, and I was pretty happy with it. Take it as you will. How about that? The video is called The Dark Side of the Nutcracker. It was by the channel Listening In. They focus on music and things like that.
Okay.
It's actually really interesting, and I enjoyed it. Apparently, Tchaikovsky took the commission for the Nutcracker and the opera, mm-hmm. Iolanta.
Yeah.
The Royal Commission, more because he just kind of felt like he had to. Like, for his career and stuff, like, he really kind of felt like he couldn't say no.
Yeah, I read that somewhere.
And so it definitely was not a passion project for him. It was mm-hmm. more just like, it was work.
Yeah.
And he was really struggling to write the music for the ballet. Like, I guess he wrote Iolanta pretty quickly,
mm-hmm.
but he really was struggling with the ballet. And I guess he wrote the most of the first act pretty quickly. And he wrote some of the dances in the second act pretty quickly too, just because they were just fun and especially a lot of the dancing in the first act is just dancing, like,
yeah,
it's just party dancing and mm-hmm. and stuff. But and so, like, a lot of the upbeat tunes and stuff he wrote very quickly, but more of the emotional stuff came much later.
Okay.
And so while he was struggling, he was on a tour in America performing in America, mm-hmm. and he eventually made his way to Europe, where he was traveling and touring, and he was in Paris. And one of the fun things is he came across the instrument, the celesta, which is how he fell in love with it, and that's the music you hear for the Sugar Plum Fairy.
Okay.
It sounds kind of like a music box.
Mm-hmm.
He fell in love with it, and I guess he wrote back to Russia, and he said, you need to buy this for the ballet. But one thing the video talked about is he found out while in Paris that his sister had died.
Oh, wow.
And he really struggled with that because he was very close to her.
Yeah.
The death of his sister actually ended up giving him the motivation for more of the emotional aspects of the music.
Mm.
So when he was writing the music, the character of Clara became a reminder of his sister.
Okay.
And the Christmas party in the first act really reminded him of the childhood that they had spent together.
Hmm.
And so it became difficult for him to write because it was emotional.
Mm-hmm.
But it allowed him to write a lot more of the darker themes in the music.
Hmm.
And more of the emotional evocative themes that you hear in the music.
Yeah.
Especially when you get to, like, the transformation scene after the party, and, like, the Grand Pas de Deux, like, before the Waltz of the Snowflake, mm-hmm. and especially with the Grand Adage during the second act, when the Sugar Plum Fairy and the Cavalier are dancing.
Mm-hmm.
In some version, it's the Nutcracker and Clara doing it.
Mm.
When my brother danced it, it was the Nutcracker and Clara. But what ended up happening was, that video, The Dark Side of the Nutcracker, it talks about how the second act echoes the first,
mm.
when you think about it. Like, obviously, it's fantastical, it's larger than life.
Yeah.
And in some ways, I like it, because the first act is very simple, it's very realistic, for lack mm-hmm. of a better word.
Yeah.
Whereas the second one is much more of, like, a fantasy adventure, and but it's like an echo, because it's like a big party, right? Like, it's people coming to, like, this big party,
yeah,
essentially.
Yeah.
When she and the Nutcracker get to the Land of Sweets and are introduced to the Sugar Plum Fairy and her cavalier,
mm-hmm.
and he tells the story of how they got there and stuff.
Yeah.
But, you know, the Waltz of the Flowers echoes the Waltz of the Snowflakes, and they're saying, like, even musically, like, you can see how they're kind of like an echo of each other. You know, this is one of those times where I'm like, I think there is truth to what you're saying, but it's also possible you might be looking a little too much into it. But I enjoyed it. It was interesting. But the music of the Grand Pas de Deux in the Grand Adage, the dum 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 dum, when they're dancing, it's so bittersweet to the sound. And it's almost sad.
Hmm.
You know what I'm talking about?
Not really.
It's like after all of the different people from all over the world have danced.
I remember their dance. I just don't remember the music off the top of my
head. It's okay.
I remember it was very...
I'll play for you some later.
It was very different.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It like brings the mood down almost.
Mm.
Like it slows down. It's after Waltz of the Flowers. It's right before the finale.
Yeah. No, I remember the do.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember what it was called.
Pas de deux? It's French for dance for two, basically.
Yeah, no, I looked it up. I was following it on Wikipedia because they had outlined the names of it in French.
It's, well, because remember, in ballet, all of the terminology is in French.
Correct, yeah.
Because, like, in singing, all the terminology is in Italian.
Mm-hmm.
And everything else is in English.
Yeah.
But the video talks about, and this is going to get a little technical, so bear with me. If you're musically inclined like I am, this is probably fascinating. And it's hard to talk about it without hearing it, but like I said, bear with me. So in the first act, when the mice come and stuff, and it starts to get kind of creepy and the room starts transforming, the music, it keeps modulating up. It's like do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do, right? It's okay if you don't remember.
Yeah,
That's why I'm like humming it for you.
Yeah.
But it keeps going. Do 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 do. Right. It keeps going up. It keeps going up. But then it'll come back down. Do 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 do. Right. And it'll add different instrumentation and stuff. But it doesn't really go anywhere.
Yeah.
Like it just moves on.
Mm.
And the video was talking about how like it never like bothered him, but it always kind of left him like, well, what's gonna happen?
Mm-hmm.
You know. And it kind of helps lead into later on, like with some of the dancing. But then he was saying when you listen to it, the culmination of all of that ends up being the grand adage in the second act with the dum, bum, 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 bum. Because it's coming back.
Okay. I can, now that you're humming it, I can hear the reverse, the echo, if you will.
Right. Yeah. And so it resolves it essentially.
Okay.
And you're saying like it's all leading to that.
Yeah. I have to actually listen to it because honestly, as I'm listening to it, because a lot of it was stuff I've heard for the first time, the only ones that stuck out were the stuff that I've heard over
you're used to the Nutcracker Suites, really.
Again. Yeah.
The Tripak, which is the Russian dance. And
exactly, yeah. And so anything, or just from the commercials, I mean, tons of commercials came to mind.
Of course.
And so those are the ones that stuck. But yeah, no, I
yeah. But when you think about...
I'll have to listen to it again, just the music.
Yeah. When you think about like... Tchaikovsky going through, you know, the sorrow of losing his sister and kind of reliving his past with the story of the Nutcracker with Clara and everything.
Yeah.
And you can really hear the sections of the ballet where he might have been fueled by that sadness.
Yeah. No.
There are definitely a lot of moments in the ballet that are very emotional.
Yeah.
It was one of the things that I thought was actually really interesting is apparently Tchaikovsky had also been challenged by a friend to compose a melody based on the sequential notes in an octave.
Hmm.
And so Tchaikovsky rose to the challenge, and the result is the grand adage from the Grand Pas de Deux in the second act, danced by the Sugar Plum Fairy and her cavalier. And I never noticed that before. But that is literally an octave. It's a sequential notes in an octave. Because the octave, you know an octave, right, in music?
Correct, yes.
For those who don't know, an octave comes from eight, right? Eight. Like octopus.
Yes, I was just thinking that.
Or octagon, right? Oct. Yes. Anyway, so an octave, it's got the different notes, right? It's like do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do. Right.
And so what is he uses that in that dance?
So he was challenged to create a melody that was a sequential, using all the sequential notes in an octave.
Huh.
And Tchaikovsky asked his friend, does it matter if it's ascending or descending? And he said no. And so when he wrote the Grand Adage, it's literally an octave in sequential order descending. So it's like do, 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 do. So from the first one to the last one, it's the octave.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Huh. Now I really have to go back. I'm really intrigued.
Right?
That is so cool.
But it's like the way he orchestrates it works so well.
Yeah.
And I think part of the reason why it feels so bittersweet and sad is because it is in descending order.
Mm.
like psychologically, when we hear something in descending, we just feel more sad. Whereas if we hear it in ascending, depending on how you do it, it can raise the stakes and raise the tension, but it usually makes you kind of happy.
Yeah.
And so psychologically, it's actually very fascinating, I think.
Hmm. I have to. One thing with music is it's for me watching it, watching something with music in the background, I usually don't appreciate the music as much because I'm also visually watching something. And so like when kind of a different, completely different story. I remember the first time I actually had an full album for the Star Wars first movie.
Nice.
The soundtrack. But I did something I never did had done before was I just I put on headphones like I'm wearing right now as we're recording, and I listened to it with my eyes closed, and it was amazing. I never realized. Yeah, and so now I kind of want to do this to both this one and the Sleeping Beauty. Go back and actually listen to it.
Oh yeah, you definitely should.
Yeah,
because there's definitely things in Sleeping Beauty that you missed.
Okay.
Yeah, that was something. Sleeping Beauty definitely seemed like Tchaikovsky was much more invested in that one.
Yeah.
It seemed like he became more invested in the Nutcracker because of the death of his sister.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what kind of fueled him to kind of like deepen his writing.
Okay.
And make it much more, give it a lot more depth and gravitas and make it more evocative, you know?
Yeah. And this was the last one he wrote before he
died? It's the last one. Okay. Last ballet he wrote and last opera too. Obviously, I mean, you know, he turned it into the Nutcracker Suite, but yes, this was the last one he wrote. And I remember telling my father this at one point, that it seems like when he wrote the Nutcracker, it was much more streamlined in that he didn't really waste any time and that like everything really had a purpose.
Yeah. Like Act Three.
Yeah, like there was no weird flourishing of music anywhere. Like it wasn't like I need to add music here for someone to dance to. Like everything really seemed to fit within what was required was for the most part.
It was very German.
Sure. Orderly. But still, like, you know, but still very romantic and
oh yeah,
all that.
Yeah. Yes, because I appreciated both halves, but for completely different reasons.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, I think in the first half, I actually enjoyed watching the acting and the more choreographed kind of little dance they did and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, and in the version we watched, they do a really great job of background acting.
Yes.
Like they really fill out the space and make it feel real.
Yes. I love watching the background characters and everything that's happening in the background. The angel. I liked the angels, the fact that you couldn't see their feet, but you knew they were dancing and, you know.
Well, you know what? That's something that they added for their version too.
Did they?
Some versions have angels later on, like in the transition from the first to the second act. But their version is one of the few versions that I've ever seen. I think the version is the only one I've ever seen where the whole party scene like stops because she sees the angel.
Yeah.
I've seen variations of that where the party scene freezes for different reasons.
Mm-hmm.
But there's, I think, the only version I've seen where Clara is aware that the life-sized angel has appeared and is doing something. And so she is trying to figure out why everybody is frozen, but then things go back to normal.
And it was, I don't know if they did it on purpose, but it was a nice reference to the novel as well, the book.
Right.
Because then,
like I said, I think that they definitely were trying to reference the book in their version. But I think from a creative standpoint, it worked really well because they already had the prologue, right? Which introduces you to a little bit of the backstory to Drosselmeyer and the Nutcracker as his nephew.
Yeah.
And it hints that Drosselmeyer is going to do something, right? Because he takes the Nutcracker as an afterthought.
Yeah.
But then when we meet Clara and the Stahlbaums at their Christmas Eve party, there's that moment where she sees the angel and everybody freezes and she's trying to figure out what's happening, right?
Mm-hmm.
It kind of hints that she has almost like a sort of power or ability that others don't.
And
either her imagination has there's something with her imagination or something.
Yeah.
That's going to play in later.
Okay.
And I think that was very smart of them.
Yeah.
Because it kind of clues the audience into some of the characters and like some of the plot that's going to happen.
Mm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Because eventually all the angels like escort them to the Land of Sweets.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that dance. I don't know. I just something about it. I just thought it was cool.
It really depends on how you do it. I've seen productions where I'm like, can we just move on?
Yeah. No, but like I said, I appreciated them each for different reasons. Mm-hmm. And then the dancing in the second half.
Don't you love that transition between the battle scene and then like when she dances with the Nutcracker when he's transformed and then into the snow scene?
I don't remember it.
So when she shrinks down, yeah, right? And then they have the big battle, which is really fun. And then when the Nutcracker is hurt and he like collapses, mm-hmm, and Clara comes up and she hits the Mouse King with her slipper.
Yes, I remember that.
And that's what helps save the day.
Yeah.
And so the Nutcracker has fallen and all the characters are leaving. And then it's like a huge sheet. It's like really shimmery. It like kind of falls down behind them. And it sections them off from the rest of the stage. And it's like really kind of simple, but fantastical. And it's very like almost like diaphanous and flowing.
Okay. I probably wasn't paying attention. I think I was reading the internet at the same time.
I'll show you. Mm-hmm. But what ends up happening is they're dancing in front of it, and it just focuses all of your attention on them.
Okay.
And like there's nothing on stage except for the really simple backdrop.
Okay.
But then as soon as they finish the dance, the backdrop falls.
Mm.
And then it's pulled into the stage.
Mm-hmm.
And you see all around them, they're in the snow forest.
Yeah. I do remember.
Like it, their transitions are so good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
From what I remember. Yeah.
And their version's fun because it's kind of similar to the original Hoffman version in some ways, but it's also kind of their own version where, mm-hmm, the Land of Sweets, you find out, is actually a glorified and more structured version of the cake that Drosselmeyer had brought in the first act for the Stahlbaum family.
And my wife noticed that. Mm-hmm. She's like, is it the background's the cake?
Mm-hmm.
I was like, oh my gosh, I did not catch that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, it was good. I enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It was a lot of fun. I love watching The Nutcracker. Mm-hmm. It's so good. All right. I think I'm running out of things to talk about. But I'm glad that you enjoyed it. It's so much more fun live.
I kind of got that impression, but with ballet in general.
Yeah. I mean, I love watching recorded versions because you get to see things that you might miss live.
Mm-hmm.
And it focuses in on the characters and stuff, which is a give and take because, especially with this production,
yeah,
it so much is happening behind them that like you miss things behind them.
Mm, okay.
But, you know, it draws your attention to things you really need to see.
Yeah.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
I think next I'm going to watch the Macaulay Culkin version.
I've seen it. It's kind of fun.
Is it?
It's a little fun.
It popped up when I was searching for this one.
You know what's the version you should watch? You probably came across it. It's the Maurice Sendak version. I think that's how you pronounce his last name. He was a children's book illustrator.
Okay.
And he was commissioned by the Seattle Ballet Company. I know it was in Seattle, so don't know who it was, to put on a production of The Nutcracker there. Hmm. And they purposefully wanted to be much more faithful to the Hoffman version.
Interesting.
And so he created designs that were more focused on the Hoffman version, and mm-hmm, their staging was more focused on the Hoffman version.
Hmm.
And so they ended up turning their version... He ended up illustrating his own version of the book.
Okay.
Which is really cool, and I want to buy it. But they turned that production into the Nutcracker motion picture that came out in the 80s.
Oh, we did see.
Mm-hmm. And it feels like you're watching a production of the ballet, but mm-hmm, it's like three-dimensional as if it's like an actual space.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah. And that one is definitely closer to the Hoffman version, mm-hmm, in a lot of ways. And like it reintroduces Drosselmeyer as like almost like a scary character.
Mm-hmm.
And he follows them back into the Land of Sweets. And
does the Mouse King have seven heads on, mm-hmm, that one? The Mouse King has seven heads. We watched the trailer of that one.
The Mouse King has seven heads in that one. But also, that version is more adult.
Oh, okay.
It has a lot more adult themes, which are kind of hinted at in the Hoffman version.
Mm.
Like this kind of like awakening for Clara kind of thing. They definitely make changes in their version, but... Mm-hmm. Yeah, the motion picture version is a lot of fun.
Hmm.
It's a little cheesy.
Yeah.
But it's a lot of fun. And it's definitely fantastical.
Okay.
Yeah. Like, if you're going to watch a version other than the one we watched, watch that one.
Okay.
I mean, they're all great. I'll go back and tell you Matthew Bourne's version is hilarious.
He did one too?
He did. He's done a bunch.
Not vampires this time.
No. No. Except his version's fun. I like his because similar to when he did Sleeping Beauty, he tries to keep conflict and plot in his version. Whereas in the normal version of the ballet, there's basically no conflict after the first act.
Yeah. So it's just a journey.
Wait, I mean, it's fun, but there's basically no conflict in the second act, right?
Yeah.
In the Matthew Bourne version, there is.
Oh, okay.
In the Matthew Bourne version, it opens on a bunch of kids in an orphanage. Having like a really meager Christmas party. And it seems like it's like the owner's children were invited and they're like really stuck up and mean.
Yeah.
And what ends up happening is the kids, there's like two that are kind of in love with each other. And they all go to sleep. And then I can't remember it all, but what ends up happening is the kids end up turning on the people at the orphanage to like escape. It gets a little creepy, but they escape and they're all happy. And the Clara character and the little Nutcracker character, who's just a human in this version, they go to run off together and are really happy. But what ends up happening is all these like skaters, like ice skating people come out, right? And you're introduced to the alter ego versions of characters you met earlier. Including like the boy and the girl who were like really mean. And now they're like the prince and the princess of the land of sweets, essentially. And she's jealous of Clara. And so what ends up happening is actually it works so well with the music.
Yeah.
In the Waltz of the Snowflakes, the music kind of builds and it goes bum, right? And at that moment in the music, they like throw this gigantic like snowball at the Nutcracker character, and it hints that he like becomes an amnesiac. And so he ends up falling in love with the princess character instead of Clara.
Interesting.
It's actually really fun.
Yeah.
And so the second act is Clara and like the two other characters trying to sneak into the land of sweets to like get him back.
Okay.
Yeah. And so there is conflict because she's trying to get to him and save him and remind him who she is and stuff. It's a lot of fun and there's a lot of comedy, but it's Matthew Bourne is very weird. Yeah. I need to show you clips from it. It's pretty great.
That's funny.
Yeah. But I think that's it. I think that's all I have for now, at least. Do you want to do favorite character first or do you want to do ratings first?
We can do character.
Okay, so you can pick either the ballet or the book. Who was your favorite character and why?
I'll have to go with Drosselmeyer.
For which one, though?
Probably for both, honestly.
He's a fun character. I played him many times in the company that we had.
Oh, did you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, just because he probably had the most... Well, he's honestly, mysterious. He was... Yeah, he had the most, like... I don't want to say versatility. He had the most characterization.
Mm-hmm. And he had depth to his character.
Yes, indefinitely. Yeah. And I think, of course...
Like, there's something about him you're like, there's more to you than there seems to be, but we don't know what it is.
Yeah. Yeah. In the novela, he...
Like, you said that very Spanish.
I did. In the novela, he was...
Telenovela.
I'm surprised they haven't made one yet.
They might have.
They probably have, actually. Having the whole background story, the Berlipata story, and all that, I think I grew to appreciate his character. The kids were all right; they just seemed very basic. And even in the ballet, granted, Clara and the Nutcracker, I mean, they kind of, I guess, had the main roles, but there was never really much to them. Whereas for him in the ballet, he was kind of here and there. And he disappeared on the journey part, but it was always interesting to see what new little things he was going to do. Whether it was, you know, like even in the what do you call those, the bows at the end?
The curtain call?
The curtain call. When he comes out and he throws the confetti and that stuff. And then, or when he's bringing in the party, bringing the toys out. And
yeah, the version we watched, he definitely has some really cool, like, magical moments.
Yes. Yeah.
Like when he like lifts up Fritz at the party.
That was funny. Up into the air. And yes, throws. Yeah. Yeah. So I think for me that he was my favorite character.
Mm-hmm. I really like Drosselmeyer. I really like Clara. My favorite character is the Nutcracker, though.
Okay.
In both versions.
Mm-hmm.
There's always something about someone who's cursed that I always just find interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Especially, like, I have to get rid of the curse. I always love that fairy tale trope.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it be the beast and being the beast or whatever. Like, I always am very... I think that's also why I like werewolf stories. It's like the idea of, like, how do I end the curse of the werewolf and things like that.
That's why you like Twilight?
No. They're not werewolves in that.
Wait, then what
they're
does
like,
Jacob...
They're like skinwalkers.
Oh, that's... Yeah, I can see that.
No, like, literally, it's like the whole mythology about the Northwest Indians.
Yeah, no, yeah. I remember that from X-Files. I think it was X-Files.
They just don't call them that in the book. Anyway.
Yeah.
No, I really like the Nutcracker, especially in the book, because you get to know him more.
Mm.
He just seems so plucky and like ready to serve and to do his duty, but then this horrible thing happens to him and you know, like, now he's just trying to be human again, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I always love that it's never really spelled out to Clara what she has to do in either version.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it just works out.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that.
Cool.
Yeah. Drosselmeyer is just like the machination behind it all, you know?
Mm-hmm. The puppet master.
Right. Yes. All right. So.
Now ratings.
Yes. Now ratings. So first we will do the book and then we'll do the ballet. Specifically the version we watched, but whatever. So let's do... One is I wish I never read or watched this, and 10 being, oh my gosh, this was so amazing. I'm trying to change the grading for this. 10 being like superior, the most superior. How about mm-hmm. that?
Okay.
Book.
The book is a 6.
Okay, I think I'd agree with you. I think I agree with you. Like, it's definitely not my favorite, and there's things that I wish were different.
Yeah.
Like, there's definitely things that I wish I could change about the book. To make it more compelling and to streamline a few things and so on. Definitely the storytelling is a little antiquated.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's fine. Like, there's nothing wrong with it. It's just we tell stories differently now.
Mm-hmm.
But
I will say, now that you explained the whole enlightenment thing, mm-hmm. I appreciate it more now.
Mm-hmm.
So there is that. I still give it a 6, but I do appreciate mm-hmm. it a lot more.
No, like, I'd read it again, but I definitely yeah. think I'd let time pass.
Yeah, no, I agree.
Yeah. I think that's what's nice about Christmas things, though, right? Is,
mm-hmm.
I mean, to be fair, in our current culture in the year 2024, we are just saturated with Christmas.
Yeah.
Almost like too much Christmas.
Yeah.
Like, people are already decorating, and I think we're recording this episode on November 12th.
I know. Yes, my wife and I had a conversation about Christmas mm-hmm. decorations come up after Thanksgiving.
Yes. But the nice thing about Christmas stuff is you wait a year,
mm-hmm.
right? So, like, that's a year of not having to watch anything or listen to anything or whatever. So you build up to a point that you want it again.
Except for Christmas in July.
Sure.
Thank you, Hallmark
Channel. I don't do that. But it makes sense, right? Like,
it does.
You wait
does.
A year, you want it again, mm-hmm. you've waited this long, you're eager for it.
Yeah. I get it, because, like, every time I watch my Christmas cartoons or movies, they're not something I would watch again in the middle of the year.
And I think that's why I like annual traditions.
Mm-hmm.
Because annual traditions, whether it be for holidays or what have you, is you literally are waiting a year for it to come back. And so even though it's something you were doing every year,
yeah,
so much time has passed that you're wanting to do it again.
Yep, I agree.
The one funny thing, though, I came across once, it showed the picture of the fairy godmother from Disney's Cinderella talking mm-hmm. to Cinderella. And the original one, it says, "Now at the stroke of midnight, the spell will be broken," right? Mm-hmm. And this one, it changed it to, "Now at the stroke of midnight on Halloween, bang, Christmas everywhere.
Yep. It's kind of like pumpkin spice.
Mm-hmm. All right, so then let's grade the Nutcracker Ballet, specifically the Royal Ballet Company that we watched.
I would give it... I'm somewhere between a 7 and an 8.
Okay, pick an 8.
Okay, I'll go with 8.
Great. I pick a 10. I think I've only ever given maybe one other 10, so...
Yeah.
I think it was Matilda.
Did you? Yes. I don't remember. But yeah, no.
But to be fair, I thought about this on the drive.
Okay.
So this isn't just arbitrary. I actually was anticipating me asking this question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think I love the story so much. I love the music so much. And I love all of their designs. And this is something I could watch at other times of the year just because it's so intriguing.
Okay. Yeah.
No, and they do a great job in their version.
Yeah, no, they did, and I really appreciated that and the costuming and everything else. There was a couple little things here and there, but for the most part, I need to appreciate the music first.
Mm-hmm.
So, not that I need to appreciate it first. How do I phrase this? I want to go back and listen to the music, and I think I'll appreciate the ballet more.
Oh, I think you definitely will
once I paid attention. Auditorially, is that how you say it?
Sure.
To the music.
I love analyzing things, especially music, but maybe we can listen to it together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. So,
am I forgetting something?
Type of adaptation?
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
I guess that's important. So, this is the part of the episode where we get to talk about what type of adaptation is this.
Mm-hmm.
I will say the usual spiel. If you have not listened to any of our episodes before, I recommend going and listening to the trailer for our podcast, where Romy and I go much more in-depth on the types of adaptations that we talk about.
Mm-hmm.
There are 4 types that I came up with, and because I came up with them, they're faulty. The first one is true to source material. The second is expanded. Third is artistic. And the fourth is message-driven. And very quickly, true source material is exactly what you think it is. It's like this is exactly like the source material, like almost nothing has changed. If anything's changed, it's only a little bit. Expanded is obviously what it sounds like. It's they've added a lot to the story, but the story is still the same. It's just they've just added a lot to it. Usually it's when it's a small piece of work expanded to a longer one.
Think The Hobbit and the Hobbit movies.
Sure. Artistic is usually more metaphorical and usually symbolism and things like that. Although I think the more we've talked about this, the more I think that we just need to expand upon that.
Yeah, because I always want to call everything artistic when it's really not.
I know.
But I think it's because I have a different perception of artistic in my head.
I know, and I think we just need to be flexible on that one.
Yeah.
And then message driven is it's usually the adaptation is driven much more by a theme or a moral or a lesson or something that may or may not have been in the original version, and so changes have been made accordingly for that reason. And so you said artistic.
No, I'm gonna go with, the first one.
True to source material.
Mm-hmm.
You always do this. It's not even funny anymore.
No, I'll stick with artistic. One, because it's a ballet versus a novella. But two, I think, just the whole fact that it's, completely acted out versus, just the way, and then the dances and personifying things and stuff like that. So that's kind of why I went with artistic.
Right. Well, there's definitely things they add in purely just for the medium.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think I'm going to stick with artistic too. I know that artistic, when we voted that the Keira Knightley version of Pride and Prejudice was artistic.
Yeah. We actually motivated someone to go and read the book.
Oh, really?
Yeah. A friend, he actually went and read the book. He's seen the Keira Knightley version. That was his whole introduction to it. Yeah, and so he wanted to get more into material, into classical, kind of like a.
Did he like it?
You know what? I haven't had a chance to talk to him. He just texted me today saying that he had finished the book. So
he's like, I hated it.
I know. So I'll find out. He's probably like next Friday.
That's great.
Yeah.
Good. I'm glad.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, Is there anything else that you wanted to talk about before we end this?
Nope. I think we've exhausted this one.
All right. Great. Listeners, if we did not cover anything that you wish we did, please leave us a message. I was laughing the other day because I was editing a podcast and we were talking about leaving a comment, and I told you Spotify does not have comments. And then literally the next week, Spotify added comments for podcast episodes.
Really?
Yes. You can go on right now and you can see when you go to podcast episodes, there are now comments.
That is cool.
And I was laughing because I was editing the episode and I told you there are no comments on Spotify, and then they literally added them in.
I'll have to find a podcast. And
everything is subject to change, listeners.
Yes.
So like I said, if you are interested in more of our episodes, please listen to them. We love all the listens we can get. We do this for fun. If you want to leave us a comment now. Or you can send us an email. You'll hear it in our outro. Eric and Romy at willingtoadapt.com. Mm-hmm. Romy is planning to get some social media up.
Yes, that will be forthcoming before the end of the year.
So you have to.
By the time you hear this episode, I'm hoping to have the social media up and running. We'll probably use Instagram the most, but
maybe Facebook.
Well, you know, there'll be Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, not Twitter, X, but.
Oh, yeah, it's X now.
Yeah,
it's X now.
Yeah.
So I'm not on any social media.
I'll monitor them all, but Instagram will probably be the they'll probably thing. All start on Instagram and they get shot out to the other ones.
Got it. Well, and then, you know, maybe we'll do some more stuff in the future, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But if you all have any suggestions on other things you want us to cover, please let us know. We already have everything basically scheduled for this season on the podcast, but... You know, if you gave us something, then we're really into it. We'll do it.
Even questions.
Yes, please give us questions.
We would love to answer questions. Whether it's about the work itself, something you may have heard, anything like that.
Which of us is taller?
What's my favorite color of ice cream?
You asked me that earlier.
I did ask you that. I don't know why that popped into my head.
Technically, the answer to that question is green because I like mint chocolate chip.
Actually, now that I think about it, it popped into my head because I saw a TV show where someone had hit their head, and there was a disorder where you actually like taste colors and stuff.
Weird.
It's weird, yeah.
All right, I got a fun question for you.
Sure.
What is your favorite Christmas food?
Pizza.
It's not a Christmas food.
Christmas food. That's funny.
It can be dessert. It can be a drink. It can be whatever.
Oh, I mean, if the only thing that I really okay, so as Mexicans. So growing up, we were poor and we couldn't afford presents. And so we would just cook tamales and wrap them on Christmas. Just kidding. That was a story my dad used to tell. My dad actually would bring that up. But no.
My grandma and all my aunts and everybody make tamales every year.
I think Christmas, I think tamales, eggnog, and cookies.
Pan dulce?
No. Pan dulce is for the morning. So not usually. And then New Year's is menudo. So like... The one thing I look forward to every year for Christmas is tamales. However, because nobody I know likes eggnog.
I love eggnog.
I do too. And so I look forward every year to eggnog. I will drink it from try the store's kind, homemade type, with alcohol,
I've
without.
I've never done homemade.
I have it, but someone, I had a friend.
I usually get the one in the glass bottle because it's the best.
I haven't seen that one.
Because it just tastes different in the glass.
Okay, I'll have to look for one.
Like, what alcohol do you put in your eggnog?
Well, I usually just buy whatever is in there already.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I usually would put rum in.
Okay.
I've done it with whiskey, but whiskey has much more of a bite to it, and I think rum is a bit more smooth.
Okay. I'll have to look for a recipe this year. Oh, and if you're listening to this during Christmas time, we should say Merry Christmas. If you're listening to it afterwards,
we're
going to
get to that.
Mind. Okay.
This will air at Christmas time.
It will. But if they listen to it in January, well.
I think we've exhausted this.
Yes. Now we're just rambling.
Well, thank you again, all you listeners out there. We appreciate you, each and every one of you.
Definitely.
I'm going to give a shout out to some of our usual listeners. I know I've got the Mendoza family, and I get my dad. Other than that, everybody else is kind of here or there.
Yes, definitely. I have none. Nobody I know listens to this.
You haven't bribed them yet.
I know. My wife, once in a while. But and then to Lego, if you ever get around to this episode.
All right. Well, we'll call it there.
All right.
All right. Well, everybody, Merry Christmas.
Yes, Merry Christmas.
And we will catch you on the next one.
All right. Take care, everyone.
All right, bye.
Okay, bye.
Thank you for listening to our podcast, Willing to Adapt.
Please like and subscribe. Maybe leave a review or just share us with friends and family.
We would also love if you would follow us on social media.
If you have ideas for future episodes for us, please email us at ericandromi@willingtoadapt.com.
That's Romy with an I.
And remember, when the only thing constant in life is change, be willing to adapt.